Amen.
Please be seated. So as a number of you have remarked, this is probably the longest gospel lesson that of the church year. We're in a series where the gospels are pretty long. And I'm going to get to that in just a minute. I'd like to say just a couple of words about several of our other readings, beginning with the collect. It's a portion of Isaiah 55, and I'm telling people to, and I probably should do this myself, I'm telling others to do it, cut it out and tape it to your refrigerator. It's not a bad sort of set of questions to begin every day. First it reminds us there is something precious to us that is available to all of us without money, without price. It's purely free, this great nourishing sense of God's reality. And it's always as near at hand as we are. I mean, it's right with us. And then these questions. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? I mean, if we could just ask ourselves that deeply and earnestly, both at an individual level and at a national level, it really, what are we doing? What are we doing with our lives? What are we doing with our energy? What are we doing with our money and our time? You know, why do you spend your money for that which is not bread and your labor for that which does not satisfy? You know, asking ourselves, is this really meaningful? Am I doing what I need to do, what I'm called to do with my life? So tape it up to the fridge. And then Ephesians, just listening for those images by which we are addressed. And two of them are you who are asleep and you who are dead. Or we who are asleep and we who are dead. Both the injunction is both to wake up and to come alive. And again, this is one of those instances where resurrection is, in the New Testament, probably more frequently a metaphor for how we are to live now than it is a statement about what happens after we die. Resurrected life begins now. And so Ephesians would address us, you who are dead, come alive now. And so that brings us to this gospel, this funny gospel. It has to do with a man born blind, and Jesus heals him. And I didn't say anything at St. John's about this. You probably heard mud keeps coming up, mud, and this odd sort of, he made a paste of mud and smeared it on his eyes. Not exactly the ophthalmologist I would see now. But apparently in the Greek there's a pun which has to do with Adam, Adama. I think the Adama is the mud, but in the ear it sounds so much like the original man Adam, the original human being. And so in this, when Jesus is working with mud, the mud of Adam, and doing things not seen since the beginning of the world. We're going back. Jesus is taking part in the creative activity of God. And that activity of God is not back in the distant past somewhere. God is now creating the world. That's part of the energy that is at work, creating, restoring, sustaining, healing the world. And Jesus is saying, I'm doing that work too. God is always doing that work. And, of course, the healing took place on the Sabbath, so Jesus is in trouble yet again for doing work, which is, of course, listening to God's presence and doing what God asks Jesus to do. But it violated a religious statute, and so the religion took precedence over the act of love. And again, how many of the stories that Jesus tells, such as the Good Samaritan, are often stories meant to correct bad religion. You know, the priest and the lawyer that walked by the Samaritan, you know, the guy in the ditch, they did so because of religion. They did so because they would have risked religious defilement if the guy had been dead, and they didn't want to get compromised religiously, and so their religion taught them to be afraid of defilement and walk by the guy. So we've got some stuff going on here in this long story from John that, to me, has a lot to do with the way we make assumptions and the framework within which we understand our lives, and especially those things that we think we know. The things that we think we know in this story get people into trouble. And it starts right off the bat. They come across a guy, he's blind. And his disciples are confident of sort of the framework within which they're understanding this guy. They say, who sinned? They're assuming somebody had to sin, because the effect demands a cause. Who sinned, this guy or his parents? And Jesus basically says, that's just not the right way to think about it. That's the wrong question. It's a framework that is wrong, that assumes you can read the world. If someone is suffering, that must mean that God has punished them in some way. And so he begins to challenge the whole framework within which the disciples are experiencing this guy's blindness. And we also have been doing a lot of questioning about certain of the assumptions that have guided our religious life. And one of the assumptions that I take on with some regularity, I hope you recognize, is the Christian assumption that we are all born evil. Now that's part of the framework that has been insistent in the Christian religion since the days of St. Augustine in the 5th century. And it has shaped the mind and the heart and the soul of Western Christian people. And there was a passage in the John Philip Newell book that we read where he was in conversation with a Native American. And the Native American said how different it would have been if, when Europeans came to this country, they had been looking to see the presence of God in us. If they had been looking to see the presence of God in us, rather than assuming they were godless heathens cut off. Which is to say, if they had not been operating within the dominant Christian framework that begins by saying you're all evil from birth, and there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing you can do about it. So you're bad and you're helpless. That is part of the framework that we have inherited in the church as Christians. And an alternative to that, just to consider how different the Christian story would be if the beginning word, as Matthew Fox has suggested, is that we are beautiful creatures of God. And that we are very prone to be afraid and uncertain, insecure. We mess things up a lot. But however badly we can mess things up, it can't get down to our true essential nature, which is that we are creatures of God, we are beloved children of God, and what God has created is, in its essence, good. Good, good. God saw what God had created, and it was very good. And that includes us. And how different the story would be, how different the energy would be if every week we gathered here to remember something that we're really tempted to forget, that we're good at heart, that we are beloved of God. And how do we bring that forth? How do we minimize the things that bring suffering to ourselves and others and emphasize our true strength? And what power do each of us have? What powers do we have to do that, to bring that forth? It's a different story. And arguably, it's much closer to the story that Jesus was trying to tell us. And And these people in the story, they're just caught within sets of assumptions about religion, about God, about sin, about, you know, the cause and effect that led to this man's blindness. And Jesus is trying to say, you're all asking the wrong questions. Don't you understand that? And they didn't. And part of, I mean, the image that came to me as I was driving up, it's in the mind of Jesus, trying to talk to us is sort of like trying to talk to a group of people and we're all wearing headphones. And we're listening to our own little private music. And somebody is talking, but all you're hearing is that which is going on inside your own mind and heart. And I think a lot of the meaning of this gospel is how trapped we get. I've already talked some about frameworks, you know, framework of interpretation, but what we think we know about other people, and maybe more importantly, what we think we know about ourselves. And when we accumulate enough knowledge about the world, what that becomes for us functionally is a system of prejudice, where we know what to expect of that person, we know what to expect of that person, we know what to expect of that religion. If they go to that church, we know what to expect of them. If they're Republican, we know what to expect of them. And the world becomes simply stereotypes and caricatures, and so little of the world actually gets through to us. You know, one of the most important lines in this gospel story seems kind of small. It's when the Pharisees say, "We know that God has spoken with Moses, but we don't know where this guy comes from." And what that addresses in us is, it's like, they know, what they're saying is, we know Moses. Moses comes to us certified. It's tradition. Others have said, listen to this. These are the teachings that have been central to our tradition. We have confidence in them. But for this guy, we don't know. But what was the issue? What they had to do was look at Jesus with their own eyes and own hearts and do exactly what Jesus asked us to do. Why do you not judge for yourselves what is right? And so Jesus is right there. He's healing. The man is saying, what do you mean you don't know where he comes from? He opened my eyes. That doesn't come from a bad place, does it? And how timid we are to actually look at the world and look at what the world presents to us and make up our own minds about it. And then finally, just you could in a sense describe a lot of psychotherapy as the attempt of people to get free of the stories they have told themselves all their lives about themselves. We tell ourselves stories, and we get trapped in those stories. And we forget that this is the day that the Lord has made, and it is and God makes things new, and that means God makes us new. But any of us who've been alive for any length of time at all have noticed disturbing patterns in our behavior, and that, you know, actually I tend to do this under these circumstances, and that simply reduces me to a creature of habit, to a predictable creature, to a creature who is, as Ephesians says, either dead or asleep. And to wake up means to wake up to the newness of things and to the possibility that any of us might surprise ourselves by doing things that we haven't done before. We might be kind to a family member that we fought with for decades. We might look at them or look at ourselves Look at the story we tell about our families. Look at the stories we tell about people of a different religion, different political party. Look at the stories we tell as if they represent God's deep reality. How blessed it is to let go of some of our stories, whether they're personal stories or the stereotypes by which we sort of get the world pegged. The world's more interesting when we know less about it, and when we have real questions, and when we are paying attention in a way that will allow us to recognize love, kindness, goodness, wherever it occurs, not just in those places we've been taught to expect it. The world will surprise us if we only let it.